And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
And welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And we have a great one lined up for you tonight. We have both Alejandro Rojas, who is live with us tonight. He is on. Also, we have Ted Rowe, and he is the executive director of NARCAP. It's going to be a real interesting show. This is our first Google Hangouts. Thus, of course, we had technical problems. The chat room is not working on podcastufo.com. But it will be next week. We'll get that figured out. Unfortunately, I couldn't get a hold of the person that helps out with that at short notice. So please jump over to YouTube if you're watching on podcastufo.com if you want to get into the chat room there. So we are live streaming. Also, we have a new show coming up, the first new show, and it's called the Everything Else Show. That is coming up on March 27th with Paul and Ben Eno. Everything You Know Is Wrong, that's what they're going to talk about. Not just paranormal we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about everything else. And that includes whistleblowers. I have a CIA whistleblower on. I have Edward C. May. He was part of the Stargate project, remote viewing and all that. He's going to be on. So is Steve Callahan, who was a person that was shipwrecked and adrift for 70 days. I'm just going to try to talk to interesting people. I also know a lot of LA comedians. I'm going to be talking to a couple of those. It's a variety show. That's what it is. So looking forward tonight. I want to thank everyone that supports the show. If you'd like to help us out for $2 or more a month, you can go right to podcastufo.com and all that information is there. So I'm going to welcome both of you on at the same time. I'm really excited. One more thing. I am going to be at the UFO Congress next week out in Phoenix. If you're going to be there, a number of people have reached out to me and I'd love to hang out with you. My email address is martin@podcastufo.com. And please get a hold of me. I'd like to meet up with you. It's going to be a lot of fun. And these two gentlemen that are on right now are going to be there. Also, one more thing. As we get into the show later on, if someone watching on YouTube wants to join in and ask the guests a question, you'll be able to just put your Gmail email in the chat room and say that you want to join in. I will send you an invite so you can ask our guest directly a question that way. So, Alejandro Rojas, how are you doing? And welcome, Ted Rowe.
Greetings, aloha. Happy to be here.
Hello, I'm doing well.
And you know Alejandro, you can't get your camera to work.
I know. So I just hooked up my GoPro. Let's see if I can get this working because... So people
you just
can
don't
see.
Wear it on your head and look around. You know, I mean, that's what you do. With
so, and I, what's cool about my room is I have this nice artwork up that's made by Dale Hendrickson, who is actually someone I've talked about before because he does artwork with The Simpsons. And it's awesome artwork. And he's someone who always comes to the conference. He'll be there again. But he just is, besides being a super cool guy, he has some amazing artwork, and that's what I would have loved to have shown your audience, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
Well, I have someone just commented in the chat room, I have Japanese screens behind me, and I moved my studio. I've been trying to get rid of the static problem, so I've tried everything, bought new equipment, and finally I just moved into my guest house, and we'll see if there's any static tonight. I hope not, but trying everything.
You know, there's something else I was thinking of, too, while you were talking. What would be interesting, you talked about how, you know, the Enos and they do the everything you know is wrong type of thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of people do that, but I've never heard of a everything you know is right. Wouldn't that be interesting? But everything you know, what everything you think about life is exactly right. You are on spot on.
I would go
That's
into
what
politics.
We would call it.
I would go into politics, Alejandro, but I'm not going to touch that. But I will. I do want to read this one tweet that I just read. Okay. This was a tweet to Trump. It says, one thing that's sad, hopefully we'll have time to appreciate it later, is that there's definitely no UFOs, or Trump would have tweeted something. So anyway, I thought that was I don't want to get a lot of backlash from Trump supporters out there. I'm not saying one thing one way or the other. I'm just putting it out there. That was a tweet.
He would have tweeted about UFOs. He actually has tweeted about UFOs. Oh. I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was somewhat dismissive. It wasn't like UFOs are real or anything. But yeah, that gets into a whole other thing, which is something Ben Hantz is going to be kind of covering some presidential stuff at our conference. And it gets me thinking, though, around, you know, the strategy that Hillary's campaign had, which was to tackle the UFO issue and to talk about it. And I kind of feel like she did that to kind of get, for lack of a more PC term, and this is a group of people who don't like PC anyway, so they should not be offended, but kind of the Billy Bob crowd, you know, those Trumpers that I think they were trying to appeal to them with a conspiracy sort of thing that isn't as hardcore as some of the other conspiracies like you see on Alex Jones or something. And I think that the UFO thing was their outreach to that group. And the reason Trump didn't touch it is that he really didn't want to disenfranchise the UFO crowd. So he just didn't speak to it at all, which is probably a wise move on his part, because the Trumpers possibly, who knows, we don't have enough statistics around it, but those are the type of people who may be even more prone to, you know, believing in UFO conspiracies. So I don't know, just some thoughts, because I was talking with Ben this weekend, and I think we'll have a lot of this. You know, Ted Rowe is going to be on a panel about government files, and I want to discuss some of this, because I'm really trying to understand what, assuming there was a strategy, which I'm sure there was, why did Hillary's campaign go there? Did it help or did it hinder? And then why did Trump not jump in? Because a lot of people intuitively felt that that was some low-hanging fruit. He really could have made fun of her if he would have jumped in and said, oh, you know, Hillary's talking about UFOs and aliens. She can't take her serious.
Ah, right. Yeah. So, hey, do we have any, besides the UFO Congress coming up, which I am really, really excited about, is there anything that's happening in the skies?
Yeah, so we do have a couple of Roger Marsh stories recently that are somewhat interesting. So in New Hampshire, there was a video that was taken that is somewhat interesting, and it has some people talking. And this is a video from April 21st, 2016. It was taken at 7 p.m. So this is kind of in the summertime, so it's still light out. And the witness was, you know, sees jets all the time, but there was a light kind of following one of a jet. And they thought, you know, it was kind of weird. And the closer they looked, they could tell it was not a helicopter. And they videotaped it for a few seconds. And that videotape is pretty interesting. You do see a plane with a contrail. And then right above it, you see another object moving at a similar speed and in about the same direction, with no contrail, and it almost seems larger, and it's not obviously an aircraft. Now, it could be, of course, you know, getting people like Ted to look at it would be interesting. It could be just, some people had suggested maybe it's an aircraft that is just outside of the contrail zone, so its exhaust is not creating a contrail. It also could be much closer than the other plane. So it's difficult to tell distances, but it is a really odd video. Of course, there's always a possibility of CGI, which this could also be. Mm-hmm. So it's being investigated by New Hampshire MUFON, And so they have not finished their investigation yet. But it is an interesting video. It's not obviously CGI. But yeah, it sounds like you're looking at it right now.
No, not me. It could be Ted is in his car for the listening audience. He's in Hawaii, and he's sitting in his car out in a town not too far away from volcano. So who knows? That could have been a volcano in the background. I'm not sure.
It so really could be a volcano?
No, I think you'd see him skedaddle.
You would be looking at empty camera space, definitely.
You'd be running.
We get earthquakes, you know, pretty steadily up the mountain, and the lava kind of comes and goes, and it glows at night, and it's pretty primal, you know.
Wow.
Pay attention.
I'm going to be taking my very first trip to Hawaii. A lot of my family's been there. My girlfriend's been there. Everybody loves it. I have a friend out there. I can't remember where he's at. We're going to be in Waikiki, actually. So I am just extremely excited about it.
Wonderful.
Well, hey, side note.
That sounds like a good
time. Before I forget, I just wanted to say a shout out to last week. We had a guest cancel just a few minutes before the show, and we had Donnie Goslin, who sat in. He was a retired police officer. And I just want to say a special thanks to him. We made it through the whole 2 hours. He did a great job. A number of people have written me saying that, you know, he knows so much about the UFO topic, even more than some people that are in the field, you know? So it was pretty good.
Mm. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I'm glad that worked out. And also, just another thing, I'm going to be doing a roundtable again at the UFO Congress. So hopefully that'll be a lot of fun. I have a camera coming, so I should have a nice clean video during that as well. So that'll be live here 1 week from today. I can't believe it's already coming up.
So yeah. I do have one more story.
You mean I interrupted you? Go ahead.
Oh, no, that's okay. Sorry, we're kind of all over the place today. But so this is another interesting one. Now, this is one where you have to take witness testimony because the images are interesting given the testimony, but stand alone, as so many images do on their own. You know, you can't tell what's going on. But essentially, you can see through the woods in between these homes a bright light. This is in Idaho Falls, and this light supposedly flew over the home. And in one of the images, the light is streaking. However, of course, with a solid light, if you move the camera, it's going to look like it's streaking. This picture was taken only recently in February 5th. But, you know, given the testimony, they said there were a couple people. This object passed over the house and was in a sphere shape, but it looked like it morphed into more of a kind of a longer sort of shape. And they said that it was very silent, and that their quote was, the sound had deadened around them. So for some reason, there were no birds. It just got very, very quiet as this object went by. So this is another odd one, actually, given the photos, because it looks like a very, very bright object. Now, if you had the photos by themselves, you might say it could be Venus, you know, that is out there, or perhaps a light on a light post, often in the distance, because there's not a lot of context in all of the pictures. But given the testimony, if this thing was something that flew over the home, it's very bright. So, this is another interesting case.
Wow, wonderful. Well, is there any last thing you'd like to say, Alejandro, to the people about next week or anything? Anything change or anything? Go ahead.
Oh, changes. There has been a change. So Jennifer Stein is not going to be able to make it. She was going to talk about crop circles. She won an award last year for a documentary she made on Travis Walton. Mm-hmm. And it is a great documentary. It's got more witnesses, you know, in it than anything out there. However, unfortunately, she had a family emergency, so she can't make it. So Travis is actually going to speak instead, and he does have something new. A lot of people say, well, you know, I've seen him talk, and it's great, but I've heard it all. But he wants to talk about something new. So he wants to talk about the credibility factor, which ought to be interesting coming from him. So essentially how people have reacted to his case, how the media has reacted then versus now, and kind of how that brings up credibility issues, not with just his case and how he feels his case is credible, but what makes a case credible or not credible. So from his perspective, I think that'll be pretty interesting. And he'll be doing that talk on the first day. Also, there's a lot of news right now about Tom DeLonge and his nonfiction books coming out, the first one coming out in March. And he is supposed to, and this is, I really haven't talked about this much, so he's supposed to be providing some sort of groundbreaking information to us that we'll be able to share at the conference. You'll hear it first at the conference, but of course, we're a news organization. We don't hold on to info. It's all about getting it out there. So we'll share it with the general public soon after we share it with the conference goers. So that ought to be interesting.
Wow. I hope he does on the first day so I can say something at the hangout
next
week.
I'll tell you when it'll be. It won't be until Saturday, assuming it happens, because we haven't gotten it yet. But it'll happen Saturday evening at the banquet.
Okay. Now, the thing about Travis, I've talked to him many times, you know, off mic, and he's very intelligent. And also,
he is.
He has some great perspectives. I did an interview one time, and I said, I'm going to do an interview with you and not talk about your case at all. Talk about everything else. And it was actually really, really good. He's really a fascinating guy. And he has a, you know, of course, he has a perspective different than most people could possibly have.
Mm-hmm. I agree. He's very quiet. Mm-hmm. But when you really start getting him to talk about some of these topics, you find that he's actually, you know, given all of these things a lot of thought. And he's an honest, kind of heartfelt person. So you see this is kind of, he's thinking, you know, there's no filter there. Or it doesn't feel like there's any, you know, any filter as far as ego and stuff like that. It's all about thinking about the phenomena.
Right.
And how it affects people.
That's right. Well, you all set. Thanks so much, Alejandro.
No problem. Thank you. I look forward to seeing you both. You don't know how excited I am to see both of you, and so happy you're going to be part of the conference, Ted. I've always, you know, been excited, and I get kind of hesitant to approach you and Dr. Haynes because I know how serious you are with your research and how careful you are, just like Leslie Kane is with the venues that they approach. So very honored that
you're going to be very much. Mm-hmm. I'm looking very much forward to being there and sharing with you and your crew some things that nobody has heard before. I've got a story to tell. So
great.
Awesome. To it.
All right, Alejandro, thanks so much.
All right. Yep, we'll see you guys soon.
All right.
Okay.
See you in a few days. Yep. Okay. So Ted Rowe, he is the co-founder and the executive director of NARCAP, which actually stands for the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena, and established back in 1999. So Ted, again, welcome to the show. Great to have you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Martin. I look forward to it.
And, you know, we have questions rolling in already, and I just looked a few minutes ago. We have a whole slew of questions up on our forum for you as well. And I'm not sure how many questions we're going to get to, but first of all, I'd like to talk, before we get into the topic of NARCAP, I'd like for the listening audience and watching audience, actually, to know a little bit about you. Can you give us your background and what made you actually get interested in this topic to start with?
Well, I came into UAP studies, honestly enough, from personal experience. It started when I was a kid, and I'd seen some things. And as I got older, I continued to see things from time to time. And And eventually I saw something and I contacted NASA at NASA Ames Research Center, and Dr. Haynes came back to me.
Oh.
And I discussed the case with him and went through an investigative process, and somewhere in that he invited me to help him set up this reporting center, and I've done that, and we've run it together for the last 17 years.
Now, how did that, was that his brainchild, the whole thing?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, he was heading towards retirement. He was looking for a project. And originally, the scope was international. We talked about it and scaled it back a little bit, and then went ahead with a basic business development, trying to get the process to work. Of course, it's a new idea, and getting it to work is challenging. It always was.
I had met Dr. Haynes down in North Carolina, I think it was like 3 years ago. Really had some great conversations with him. And he wasn't really excited to be on the show because of the name of the show being UFO podcast, UFO. And I want to talk to you a little bit about that, but I want to make sure I don't forget that. I'm right making a note. But if you go ahead and continue about your background, and did you have any science background at all yourself, or is it just administrative?
It was administrative primarily, but I grew up in an aviation household. My dad was an air traffic controller in Great Falls, Montana. I grew up there in the 60s, right? He was dual rated for Great Falls International and Malmstrom, and I was around aircraft all my life. But it was my administrative help that Dr. Haynes was looking for. And so that was my contribution primarily.
Yeah.
In the process, I learned quite a lot about research and ended up writing some papers of my own. But that was all under mentorship, you know, mm-hmm. from Dr. Haynes and others.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said you've written some papers. Has anything ever been published out of NICAP, NARCAP?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, we published on our own site, but generally speaking, there is no authoritative source for publication for UAP. Used to be Journal of UFO Studies, but there's really not a lot out there right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I'm looking to remedy, in fact.
Oh, good. So you started in 1999. And
yes.
How was it immediately accepted? And did you actually have to do a lot of outreach to, aviation groups and things like that? How'd the ball get rolling on this?
Well, we had some help. Of course, Dick worked at Ames Research Center, and they have an aviation safety research office there. And the director there was a friend of Dr. Haynes and had a high interest in what we were doing. We ended up through his help briefing the FAA's aviation safety reporting system analysts at a bunker there at Battelle. And then and we're just kind of leaked out. We let it grow organically. We didn't push too hard because the subject is tricky. It's difficult for pilots and air controllers. There's a perceived risk in discussing these things or reporting them.
Now, is that the same for every airline, or is it airline per airline?
That's a very good question. And what we learned, we actually did an aircrew survey project, and we went to different airlines and asked to put this survey in their ready rooms. And a number refused us, and then one or two accepted. So it seems to me that it's institutional. It's not industry-wide as far as difficulties around the subject.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of friends that are pilots, and I spoke to one and asked him if he had ever seen anything, and he flies international. He said he himself has never seen anything, but he does know other pilots, and they don't talk about it. And so I asked him, I tried to get a hold of him before this show, but I wasn't able to, but I did ask him at that time if those pilots reported it. He didn't know. But it's does every I don't want to say every pilot. Do most pilots know that they have a place to go to report something?
Not at this point. No, it's word of mouth, and we've done some promotion, of course, with NARCAP and let it grow organically. But the FAA is if you go to their manual, if a pilot can't identify something that he's concerned about, they don't, they refer him away from the FAA. They're not interested in his information. The only way he can get it into the FAA system is through the ASRS, which is a confidential, non-punitive reporting system.
Really? Okay. And why do you think that? Is it just threatening to them because it can't be identified? Why would you think the FAA keeps that as taboo or out of the system?
Well, you know, that's a good question. It was, there was all kinds of protocols around handling unidentifieds through the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. GenEp, 126, service communication information for reporting visual important sightings, this kind of stuff. A pilot could be fined or imprisoned for talking about what he might see in the air. They were using them for forward observers. No. They were using them for forward observers to see the Russian bombers coming over the pole and this sort of thing. So pilots in the air were technically forward observers. And as such, they couldn't talk about what they'd seen. And a lot of them didn't like that. You know, there was some definite rebellion against that regime. But that it had a chilling effect that continued into the 70s and 80s. And I think it's in management now. Mm-hmm. They just don't talk about it much. You know, some do. Mostly don't. You need now, to get them in a safe environment.
Yes, right. I understand that. Now, is there any such thing as a NARCAP looking into historical cases, or do they just stay with contemporary reports?
Well, of course, primarily we're looking for fresh cases, but mm-hmm. we do collect historical cases. I hand them over to Dick. Or if he receives them, he takes them and puts them in his AirCat. It's called Air Catalog, which is a case file he's put together of about 3,400 aviation cases involving incidents or observations that seem to be related to UAP or unidentified aerial phenomena, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So we collect them, but if they're not current, we don't devote a lot of resources to them unless they're just really juicy, unless there's just a lot of information available.
Does it also depend on, let's say, if there's not a lot going on, like you may want to dip into something from the past or something like that, or do you just keep the channels open for anything that may happen?
Well, we keep the channels open, but there's plenty of chatter. People are talking. We have international technical specialists and research associates that are writing papers that are peripheral to our study. We're learning about UAP cases in other countries as specialists step forward and offer their historical sort of compendiums of UAP-related events that might be aviation-related in their countries. And we've been collecting some of these. We've heard from Argentina. We've heard from Czechoslovakia, I think. It's developing, you know.
Yeah.
These things happen everywhere, near as I can tell. So.
Now, what about helicopter? Do you do any helicopter pilot reports?
Oh, sure. I wrote a paper for a project we did with NARCAP called Project Sphere, and I wrote the U.S. section on it. I did a study of 120 aviation cases that seemed to involve unidentifieds, and there was helicopters in that in the breakdown and all that. There were helicopters. There were military transport, military fighter aircraft. I broke it all down. Commercial aircraft, private aircraft, civil aviation.
Tell me a little bit more. Tell us a little bit more about this Project Sphere, please.
Well, Project Sphere, we took the model off of the Condyne report, mm-hmm. which was the report by the British Ministry of Defense. It was a comprehensive study. Not the best study. They painted with a broad brush, but they hit a number of different aspects of the UAP phenomena. They looked at microwave effects. They looked at influence on cars. They looked at influence on human beings. They looked at sightings and pilot reports. They looked at different aspects of it. And then they considered the phenomenon as it presented and tried to come up with some sort of coherent theory, which I don't stand behind, but, I thought the model was good. And so we went after spherical UAP. Dr. Haynes had been working on this for a while. So we started doing, we did a study on spherical UAP. We broke down, we studied them by geometry. We studied them by radar cross-section. We studied them by the way they're reported. We studied them by photographs. We So we compiled, there were about 15 of us involved, and we wrote about 22 papers, and that all falls under Project Sphere on the NARCAF website.
Okay. Would you say that some of these spheres appear to be under intelligent control?
It would hard to be argue. It's hard to argue either way, but you know,
are there some cases in particular?
Well, we have one on our site, NARCAP Technical Report 12, and it involves some astronomers who were on the ridge on San Bruno between the ocean and on the coastal ridge between the ocean and San Jose Airport. And an airliner was coming in. They had a pretty good camera at the time. It was 8 megapixel. It was 2005, I think. And they saw a small light following the aircraft. And so they started shooting a sequence of pictures. And at one point, this little ball of light pulls up under the tail of the aircraft and holds position for a little bit and then breaks away at an oblique angle. And I don't know how to write a paper that describes a ball of light behaving intelligently, but, you know, there are attributes there that need to be looked at. I don't think that we should throw the baby out with the bathwater. We want to be careful here.
Right. Now, what is the relationship between these spheres and the Foo Fighter reportings during World War II?
My guess is that it's the same phenomenon, but that's a guess. I mean, the difference between, you know, guessing that and knowing it. I mean, are the orange balls of light that pilots see at altitude the same one that Earthlights people see on the ground? You know, I don't know how to connect that. You know, what kind of study would actually validate that?
All right. So what
spectrum?
Okay. So let's go into. I haven't even looked at any of these questions yet, but let's go into what happens once a pilot reports a sighting. How does it? You said it goes to Richard first.
Yeah, so basically, if it comes to me, I hand it off to him. It'll show up in my email or his, or it'll show up in our snail mail, and we reach out to him. We find out how sensitive they are to confidentiality. We treat it as if it's going to be confidential, and we de-identify. We do a full investigation as fully as we can, and then we'll de-identify the case, and unless in the rare situation they want to be related to it, and then it becomes a white paper, and we publish that.
I see.
That's the short path.
Uh-huh. Are there some? Are most cases? I don't want to say most cases. Is there a majority of cases that you figure out some type of natural phenomena that happened? I heard you say earth lights, like sprites, or there's ball lightning. There's all kinds of natural phenomena that you might be able to observe from the skies.
Yes. Yes. And we look very carefully at all these possibilities. Dr. Haynes is a perceptual psychologist, an expert in visual acuity and expert reflections. This sort of thing, and very helpful in breaking down illusions that pilots are susceptible to, and what's left.
And why would they? Can you go into why pilots would be susceptible to illusions?
The same reason all of us are. For example, if you were to sit in a very dark room and to have a single point light source, a small one, like an incense stick. Just the little glow on the end of the incense stick. And if you sit that very still on the other side of the room in the dark, and you sit still and you look at that, it'll start moving. You'll see it vibrate, boom, 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 boom. And it's vibrating with your heartbeat. It's called autokinesis. And it can fool people. They think the light's moving, but it's their eyeball that's moving. Okay, and that's one type of illusion that a pilot can be, or a delusion that a pilot can be susceptible to. There's a lot of stories of pilots flying into the ground or nearly hitting intersections where there's red and green lights, thinking they're following aircraft into the on a pattern.
Wow!
And they're flying visually, so they're not looking at their instruments when they should be flying instrument, and not looking out their window. You know, so there's different things that can happen that can explain some types of observations and incidents. And there are others where they go right ahead and make reports and file them with NTSB. been away for nothing. Basically, nobody could resolve it, but they were frightened enough or concerned enough. Souls they felt were in danger. So they made a report, you know. And the kind of reports we get are like loss of separation, near mid-air collisions, dynamic passes around the aircraft, this kind of thing. So it's active enough that it makes people nervous, makes pilots nervous.
I bet. Someone wanted to know, how does NARCAP, is it a nonprofit or how is it funded?
Well, NARCAP is a nonprofit. We're 501c3 registered. Generally, ideally, we run on a standard funding drive program where we manage memberships and take donations in that fashion. But more or less, we run it out of our own pockets. We don't really pick up that much funding. And we haven't had any really ambitious funding attempts out there. The kind of work we do, we can pretty well manage on our own. And it's kept us from being beholden to anybody, which has been part of my motivation for not seeking big money donors.
Yes, right. Yes, I heard you talk on another podcast where Bigelow at one time wanted to buy some files. You could have the copies, but he wanted the originals, and you vetoed that whole idea, which I thought was a pretty good idea.
Well, I didn't veto it, but I advised Dr. Haynes strongly that that wasn't the path to take, and he agreed with me. Those materials are Dick's. He's worked very hard putting them all together, and it's really his call what he does with them. And my understanding is that he's turning 80 this year, and he's signing his papers over to a university in the South, I believe, in Arkansas.
Wow. He didn't look 80 when I saw him. Wow, that's amazing. Well, yeah. 77, that is, at the time. So yeah. There's no actual office. You're spread. How many people are involved in NARCAP?
Well, we're a virtual organization. We have approximately 50 members in NARCAP US, which includes technical specialists, international technical specialists, research associates. And then we have an international branch in Germany that Hillebrand von Ludwiger is running, the guy that has MUFON CES. We're in the process of sort of consolidating NARCAP there. I believe he's got a dozen or more members of his own. Don Ledger manages NARCAP Canada for us. Mm-hmm. And
Dag Harbor, right?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's kind of our primary situation. We have some official research agreements with the government of Chile and their team and some other agreements with different associations that also help.
I became a pretty good friends with Jose Lai from Cefaha. Unfortunately, I had him and Leslie lined up recently for a show. And I said to Leslie, I was contacted by someone to take a look at Mick. I'm trying to remember what he is, Metabunk. I just forgot his last name. So anyway, I said, I think we better cancel the show. I told Leslie, until we really look into this this helicopter sighting with the infrared camera. Were you involved in any type of way with that?
No, I wasn't. And it's kind of unfortunate that whole situation,
right?
Because peer review, you know, established standards for review and publication, so that partners can be involved and that missteps might be mitigated. I reached out fairly early in our relationship with Cefaha to try and establish some of this and wasn't very successful. And I haven't been the biggest booster in terms of maintaining relationships that aren't healthy for us. A lot of my team think, well, it's better to have it than not. And well, maybe yes, maybe no. The main thing is that are you a team? Are we working together? If we are working together, then the things you say and the things you do influence our image and affect the things we're trying to say. So how do we do this in a way that's safe for all of us and that we can move our message together to make this happen? And so far, I haven't really found that inroad with Cefaha to make that function really occur. There's been a couple of situations that have arisen that have made me very nervous as an administrator. And of course, I bounced this off the advisory committee and off of Dr. Haynes. And I think I'm, of course, it's my job to think I'm right, but some of these things need to be dealt with properly. And there's a reason that these guys are research scientists and not businessmen and not salesmen, you know.
Well, I think what you, NARCAP, is doing is, you know, using a lot of science, trying to really look at things logically, keeping your side of the road clean, and just doing, you know, really the best that you can do. Why can't a government agency do the same thing? You just told me you're virtual. You have a virtual office. You have 50 or so people spread around. Understand the cost for some type of similar agency shouldn't be too high at all. And I just wonder why more governments aren't doing.
Well, it's, you know, Leslie Keynes brought this question up too. Why this hasn't been championed more by the U.S. government. I don't really have a good answer for that. I know that behind the scenes, there's an interest in the subject and the phenomenon. It's just social conditions and the way people play out their fears in public. They don't want to be associated with this. It can affect their careers. It can affect their image, which is interesting because that's how I met Leslie, really, was at in Washington, D.C., briefing Representative Davis and other congressmen trying to manage an initiative to move information forward. That's how Podesta learned of the term UAP, was because we briefed him on it. Dr. Haynes came up with the original definition for unidentified aerial phenomena in 1980. And we decided in NARCAP that the term UFO wasn't accurate, and it was a bit pejorative too. So we suggested that unidentified aerial phenomena was more accurate, and then we could say unidentified aerial phenomena / object or / light.
Wow. I wonder how
More accurate.
Wonder how Richard felt about Hillary Clinton using that word.
It was a big thrill for all of us. I knew that Podesta's crew had been paying attention. We had we took several trips to Washington, D.C. Dr. Michio Kaku vetted a lot of the materials that we presented upline. Eventually, it ended up being a congressional hearing. But the Department of Homeland Security sort of skewed it away from the UFO, UAP thing into something less.
Now, have you ever had a conversation with him, Michio Kaku?
No, not directly. No. Well, with Dr. Kaku, yes.
Yeah. Oh, you have.
Yeah. I spent most of an afternoon with him.
Did you ever get into the topic of UFOs with him?
Oh, yes. He was reviewing our materials to advise congressmen. Yes, we talked quite a lot about it. His impression was that he was looking at exogenous incursions, and he felt that it was appropriate to say that. I think it, in a way, it kind of is, because there's a real trend to want to treat this all as a science problem. You know, science problem, right? We're going to solve this, and then we'll have the emphatic evidence that's so perfect to put our logical box together and explain who these guys are and what this is all about. It's actually a tactical problem. And by the time science gets around with all of that, we may be very far behind the eight ball. And if we suspect that these are exogenous incursions, then be vigilant. You know, maybe you can't prove it, but, you know, we have Navy SEALs in action all around the world every week somewhere, blowing things up, taking pictures, whatever, you know. Where's the evidence? How much evidence do they leave behind, you know? And how much evidence do you expect an advanced culture that's capable of doing what some of these lights and objects are suggested to be able to do? How much evidence does that leave behind? And are you setting the bar too high to defend yourself? you know, I'm running a research team, but I'm not a researcher. You know, I'm an experiencer, and I'm somebody who's looking at the whole picture here. And in my mind, if we want to take it seriously that these are exogenous incursions, then taking it seriously means being more vigilant, collecting better data, doing a better job of crunching that data, having enough information to fall back on in case it confirms that yes, we are visited. Then we've got, you know, half a library of people's, of good, smart people thinking about it and they're writing to fall back on to help us try and deal with it. I can't say that any particular case that NARCAP has engaged has been indicative of an alien incursion, but we're having a lot of reports of this kind of thing going on, and it's not something you want to get wrong. I would rather we spent 50 years chasing shadows than not be in a proper footing if it actually happened. You can't defend the planet. So how vigilant should you be? You know, I think you should be very vigilant. You know, just be vigilant.
Yeah, I do too. You know, I've been doing this for a rather short time compared to a lot of people out there, but you know, when I started this, I was thinking that, you know, I would know more, and I just realized that that's not really so. It just seems like there's so much to this. one thing, I have said this on my show a couple of times, and it was a guest that I had. He was a senior visiting scientist and astrophysicist at NASA. And he said that quietly, some of him and, you know, his colleagues in conversations said or agreed on that if a civilization could get through the bottleneck of technology without blowing themselves up, they'd probably be traveling the stars and visiting other planets. Mm-hmm. This is someone that was at NASA. And, you know, I mean, it just seems that, you know, one of the issues that we have here is that it's not taken seriously. I know there's, you know, reasons for that, the ridicule factor, the Robertson panel, mm-hmm. And different situations that cause that. Have you firsthand seen any of that, the ridicule part of the whole thing?
Oh, sure. Sure. I've lived it. I have a family and half of them don't support me at all in this.
Really? Wow.
I pay a price for doing what I do. And I think a lot of us do. I think a lot of us were dedicated to engaging this, and we're trying to get to the other side of it without us, you know, trying to just get the answer. A lot of us pay a high price.
I'm going to ask you, do you feel the same way I do? Do you know any more about it since you started
than you did before? You know, I came into it because I've seen things already. Mm-hmm. So it really didn't matter what I knew or what I didn't know. It was in my body. It's in my nervous system. I had trauma from it. I went through a whole journey of dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, working it through, which led into freediving, which is one of my passions. And reawakened my training in Budo, in martial arts, Japanese Zen arts and Zen training, to the point where I was invited to teach at a Zen temple, teach Japanese sword. I went from an unawakened person, a person who wasn't self-aware enough and who was mystified by the idea of an alien presence, and particularly in love with the idea that I had some experience with what looked like that. And I thought I was special. I thought I knew something. I thought I had something to say. And I've come to learn that first off, I'm not special. These things probably shouldn't be happening to me or other people, and that it may not be a good situation, and that I need to choose my words carefully and choose my behavior carefully around it. I'm a carrier of information, one of a number of us in our society. And to do that correctly means I need to take it seriously. And taking it seriously means getting yourself out of it, getting your opinion out of it, get your just look at what's happening don't make it about you. For me, for a long time, it was about me. Oh God, it drove me. I was obsessed.
Mm-hmm.
I answered emails at 3 a.m. on Christmas, you know, for years. calling Dick every other day or two, dealing with my team and being paranoid and hypersensitive about things going right or wrong in my organization and all of it. And as I trained myself and followed the training laid out for all of us, I became more rational, less delusional, less self-absorbed, more open to information, more aware of what logic and rational understanding is and how to break down logical arguments to see whether they're specious or not. And it changed me considerably. It was like working on a mystery that you can never solve, but you hold the same standards and you tilt at it every day and it turns you into something else.
Wow. Interesting. Well, a few people in the chat room are obsessed with what's in your car. And I noticed it looks like a samurai sword handle right behind your shoulder there, the black handle.
Yeah, I'm teaching a class tonight. I teach Naido, which is Japanese sword. So I've got several of them in the car here.
And you have a dog. Did I see a dog's ear poke up a minute ago?
You certainly did. That's my good boy, Max.
Max, be a good dog. He's not barking.
He's crashed. We're letting him sleep.
There's a question in the forum. How does NARCAP differ from other UFO research organizations?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've been asking myself that for a while. And asking myself, what is the point in research organizations, per se? There's a real problem here. The cases get written up, the information gets developed, papers get written, and then nothing. And I know because I've published 40 papers myself of people like Massimo Teodorani and Dr. Haynes and Dr. Belli and others. We published their paper on our website. But what happens then? Nothing. Take it from me, nothing. Nothing happens. And in fact, people don't even read them. They say they read them. They say they look at them, but they don't read them. This is a problem because there's no authoritative source for UAP information for the science community. And I've taken on a project called the International Association of UAP Researchers. It's an organization I'm developing, and one of its primary goals is to develop a peer-reviewed journal for UAP research, for both historical research and scientific research, so that material can be vetted before it goes out. So that CEFA-A, for example, if they comply with the rules and don't talk to anybody and submit their material to us, we can review it, right? And then that now they've got a white paper instead of just a bundle of information they put out on the net. You know, so now there's a study and it can be referred to and can be argued with and sorted out, whichever way it goes. And that's
where do you think they went? I think there was a little lag in the internet connection. They had 2 years. They reviewed that case for over 2 years before they came out with it. What do you think they should have done differently?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because first off, it's an aviation case and they're sequestered in their director general of aviation. The CEFA-A is in the Chilean Air Technical School. So they're surrounded by aviation experts. And IPACO, which is a research effort run by Francois Louanger and Antoine Cousins, did a study on this case. And I think it's the majority report. I think it was the correct report, and they did it within the year that CEFA-A first ran into it. So I think the mistake, and I want to be very careful with our friends in Chile because they're motivated and they want to do the right thing. I know they do. But the mistake, I think, was not submitting it to peers and not having a standard and practices manual set up for how we manage information before we publish it. And I don't think they're clear inside their organization about how they do that. I know inside my own, it wasn't very clear either. But that makes or breaks a lot of organizations. You know, they put up something and they kill their credibility just like that.
Yes. Yeah, I've been concerned about that in this particular case, because that's actually the second time that this has happened. A similar thing happened. The other one was bugs. I don't know if you remember that one.
Yes, I do. And actually, we were part of that. And Dr. Haynes came back on the idea that it wasn't all bugs. I didn't do the research, but what I saw didn't look like a bug to me. But that's why we have majority and minority reports. The way these things should be done is that a comprehensive study should be done by the initiating party. Right? It's in their lab. Comprehensive study. And then they hand it out to several of their partners. And we do the same thing independently. Don't talk to them. And then we all come back together and we look at all the variants in the studies and then decide which is the majority and which others are the minority. And then publish all of it. This is similar to peer review, for example, in Nature, Journal Science, a paper is written, and then for 3 months, counter papers and counter arguments are submitted to the editor, and all of it gets published. And so you have this comprehensive block of information about these cases. I think that's the way to go. NTSB does it this way. Now, other good investigative organizations do it this way. That way you have all the information. You don't just take the majority report and ignore the rest of it. You have it all. TWA 800, for example, you're probably familiar with that.
Yes.
This case.
Shot down off of New York.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And
shot down. So it looked like it was shot down. They don't, you know.
Majority report said gas tank explosion. Minority report said missile strike. Mm-hmm. Both got published. Okay, they're all in the file on TWA 800. It's just the government said, we're not going to go with that one, we're going to go with this one. And maybe it may have been political, may have been accurate. I don't know. I'm not judging. But the point is, all the information is in the folder. It's all there. Hmm. You know, so that's a comprehensive study versus just saying, okay, we got this video, and we got this audio, and we kind of talked about it, and we're throwing it out as probably one of our best UAP cases out there. No white paper. No secondary studies, no checking with your buddies and your peers to see if we're all on the same page. And that's sort of a problem because everybody, it makes you seem like you want to be the one, you know, the one that cracks this whole thing open, you know, and that's ego. That's very ego driven and it doesn't serve us at all. And frankly, I don't think there's a lot of cracking that needs to be done. This is part of, you know, reason I'm running an association of researchers coming up rather than just NARCAP as a research group is to what do you do with the information once you've got it, you know, and where does it go? And we need that. Ufology needs that. And I didn't want to be the person to do it. I've spent maybe 10 years talking to all kinds of people, Dr. Teodorani. I published one of his first papers in the United States. I found out that he had done the lead work at Hesselin with Erling Strand.
Oh,
they did a joint Italian Norwegian study there, and a couple of years of it, and he wrote some good papers. And I had been visiting a site where anomalies were reported rather steadily, kind of a Hesselin here in North America, and I met Erling Strand there, and got referrals to Dr. Teodorani and so on. So. I published a lot of papers, you know, around this work, and but the influence of those papers is just nil. There's just nothing there, and that's the core problem. That's the core problem. As an administrator, when I look at this stuff, my scientists did what they should. You know, they wrote their papers, but you don't argue these things out in the comment section of social media. Hmm. You know, you do this work. It's important to get an answer, right or wrong. And so I've been really trying to advocate that, trying to push that idea forward. And this organization I'm developing is along those lines, to make a peer-reviewed journal available and to give to give researchers an extra sounding board and extra advisement on how to move their information in a way that science will look at it.
Can you think of any other type of situation where there's challenges like there is when it comes to UAP and UFO?
Well, there's other studies that are pretty similar. I'm not the first person to say it, but studying weather is a lot like studying UAP and UFO.
Because it's it's elusive, right? Is that what you mean?
You can't predict it. Yes, and you look for patterns, but that means documenting everything until something repeats. And it may not repeat quite the same way. So there's a lot of watching and a lot of accumulating data and looking for patterns. And in some cases, the patterns are there and they're disturbing. So if we want to get somewhere with all of this, we at some point, looking for patterns won't be enough. I think we've got a lot of cases. We've got enough cases to where something definitive could be said about exogenous incursions. I'm sure of that. We've got cases that quack like ducks, and we ignore them at our own peril. The Minot B-52 case, 1968. Tom Tulin did that study. Powerful case, radar data, gun camera photographs, gun radar photographs. Witnesses seeing a very large object with lights inside of it on the ground. Just all the things that would make you wonder if this was an exogenous incursion or not. And the Air Force came back and said it was the moon.
that's not really surprising. You hear about the Venus and, you know.
Oh, sure. You know, and the guys that really understand this are people like Jan Aldrich and Fran Ridge. These guys have been in the game since 1960, late 50s, as members of NICAP and ACRO and other organizations. They've seen a lot that we don't know about. And the Project 1947 thing, I think that's where Tom Tulin published his paper on the Minot B-52 case. There's a lot of information there. And you know, you can sit back on your haunches and say, well, interstellar travel isn't possible. But that doesn't explain the case. I don't really care about what you think about interstellar travel. There's a case here. And for us to consider it in its entirety raises implications. And those implications should never be ignored, regardless of what we think is possible or not. Because, you know, I just can't help but think that dealing with aliens could be an extremely dangerous situation. Not one that we should undertake lightly, and we certainly shouldn't be the last to know.
Right.
You know.
Right.
That's going on.
And if that is the case, if they are far more intelligent, then they can pretty much do whatever they want as far as letting us know that they're here or not, or communicate with
more
us
or not. You know, my feeling has been, you know, are they overt or covert? You know, if we look at these things and through that lens of exogenous incursions, there's other lenses to look through. But if we're going to look at it as exogenous incursions, then are they overt or covert? And a lot of people say, well, we see them at night and they zip around and they must be covert. And my feeling is that these phenomena, whatever they are, whatever agency is responsible for them, are not bashful. But the information doesn't move on the human side. These things show up in front of cities. They show up, you know, in front of aircraft and all kinds of situations. It's the information on our side of the fence that's not moving. They don't seem to care one way or the other. I mean, if there's a they, you know, if I'm not just projecting anthropomorphically, you know. So I just really want to push the caution on this. And being cautious is not ignoring it. Being cautious is understanding the implications and definitely not ignoring it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, so someone wanted to know on the chat room, this is basically a nuts and bolts organization, and that's the way you look at the UFO topic. Is that right?
It's a very narrow pie slice. Yes. Yes. It's a very narrow pie slice of all of the potential information around unidentifieds. We don't ignore the idea that there could be ESP involved or any of these other things, but what we're doing is we're looking at the physical manifestation itself, and we're using the aircraft as a sensing device. So if the electrical systems are affected, if the pilots see things, if radars makes detections or doesn't make detections, all of these things give us a picture of what's going on, and we can reconstruct that picture over and over again the same way if we just look at aviation cases. So it doesn't mean that there isn't something to a lot of the other branches of study in this field, but our focus is very narrow in that. And for us to work with pilots and air controllers and politicians and unions and this kind of thing, we got to be very careful about how we manage our image, right, what we do say and what we don't. So these are very technical guys. To be a pilot these days, you have a degree in hard science usually, and to be so they're primarily going to want to talk about nuts and bolts. They saw it was concrete, it was real, it was here, it did this, it did that, you know, not what they felt in their heads when they were sleeping one night, you know, a voice they heard, you know. So we don't ignore the rest of ufology directly, but we're very focused on one nuts and bolts aspect of the phenomenon.
Now, there are a lot of commercial pilots that were in the military prior to becoming a commercial pilot, possibly not the same type of education as a commercial pilot would have, but also I would consider also a good observer, most likely.
Most of them know their weaknesses. A lot of them can tell you, hey, I know I can't judge distance well. You know, I'm looking at blue sky and I can't tell you how far away that thing is. But there was a cloud between it and the horizon, you know, or, you know, they know what their shortcomings are often before they come to us. And interestingly enough, oftentimes they come, it's one of the first things they do when they retire.
Really? They wait till they retire?
And come and tell us about it. And we've had military pilots who were on active flights when they saw things that were very provocative, and waited a long time to talk to us about it. So,
okay. Well, I wanted to talk about this sooner or later. I was going to bring it up later, but since you just said that, gate C-17 at the O'Hare Airport, November, I think it was 2006, was it?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
It's November, so November 6 or 7, 2006. Yeah.
So the O'Hare sighting. One of the things, yes, I've said, and you know, the people that listen to all my shows are going to say, you just said that two shows ago. But one of the things I've thought was, I was, for a short time, I took a sabbatical from what I normally do, and I was involved in an airline. And I had a lot of fun. And it was a Pan Am, a relaunch of Pan Am. And basically, mm-hmm. Boy, I lost my train of thought. Jeez. Where was I going?
You're going to ask me about O'Hare, and you were giving
Yes, O'Hare. I'm sorry. Yes. So I got off the track of O'Hare. So, what happens is, you know, people leave the airline, and this is the question I have is, hasn't someone from, United that was involved in that left and talked about, this O'Hare case? I mean, it certainly was a major sighting.
Well, yeah. And we talked to people that didn't make it to our white paper on the subject. It's possible that there's still people out there that would come out and have something to say about it. I don't really consider it a case that's a hill to die on. We didn't get a lot of hard data out of it, although it's pretty obvious something happened there and something was seen. Ground crew saw it. The ramp controller saw it at United. The air controllers in the tower at O'Hare didn't see it. Apparently that was angle of incidence, angle of observation precluded it. Radar didn't detect it, but I suggest that that might be a characteristic of some UAP rather than a failure to collect data, that some UAP are not easily detectable on radar. And we know this because a lot of pilots who have UAP observations will ask for radar confirmation, and sometimes they get it and sometimes they don't.
So you actually are able to, through the organization, you can get radar data?
Yes, yes. FOIA requests. We get encrypted hard copy, and then we have algorithms and just rebuild the radar plots. Oh, wow. So we can see what it says. We don't have to have them send us an animation to see it.
Mm-hmm.
So
I know that Erica Lukes has been on the show a couple of times. She was involved recently where they were doing some work with radar data like that with the algorithms.
Yeah.
Before we move on and talk about certain sightings, I wanted to get back to the anomalous area that you were talking about. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Well, it's pretty well known there are sites in the United States and elsewhere in the world where light phenomena are observed. Brownie Mountain, North Carolina, is one of them. Marfa seems to be one of them.
Brown Mountain, you mean? Is that?
Yeah, Brown Mountain in North Carolina. Call it Brownie because I think of the sprites, right? Brownies. Hanford up in Washington State is another place where things are seen. And then there are places down in the desert southwest where they're seen also. And one place in particular I've been to is rather remarkable that way. I've been there four times, and I've seen unidentified aerial phenomena every time there. Wow. Haven't been able to get a lot of data on it, although we're working on that. Massimo Teodorani, Dr. Teodorani, has been there, and so has Erling Strand and some others. It's a very unusual place in a lot of different ways. But it really underscores, you know, how important it is. We have this information, these basically laboratory environments around us, and we need to bring instruments to bear. We need to do instrumented studies, kind of like what Erling's doing. Dr. Teodorani is heading a project with Leslie Keene and Jose Lay and Mark Rodiger from QFOS called UFO Data. And it's basically, they want to recreate the instrument packages at Hestalen at some of these sites and do some data capture. The phenomena there are very interesting and very strange. It's a very unusual environment all the way around.
Can you describe typical, or you say it's unusual? What's unusual about what you have actually witnessed there?
Well, it's unusual seeing balls of light fly around anyway.
Yeah,
I've seen that there in a couple of shades and a couple of different permutations. I've seen what look like discharge phenomena. They seem to be blobs of plasma that orange, and they sort of ignite and fade away. I've seen UAP coming to the site and disappearing, and I've seen them leaving the site and disappearing. I've seen them coming up through the canyons and then over the site and then disappearing. So it's an important site for Native Americans, that's why we don't really disclose the area. But what I want to do is do a return. I'm trying to do some support work for Massimo and take a research group out there very soon. Hopefully we can get five or six more visits out there and maybe come up with something concrete to share.
Okay. I think this is just for the regular listener. I think I just heard static. Static is driving me crazy, actually. I've done everything. I've moved to a different building. I've bought new equipment. I'm not sure what I'm gonna do. I guess I'm gonna try a different computer next week. It's just driving me crazy. So I do apologize to the listener, because I just heard static again. Replaced wires, cables, you name it. I've one person in the chat room right now, I took his advice. I made sure none of the wires were crossing on audio wires. It's just nothing I seem to be able to do. The only thing I can think of is having an extra computer nearby. You know, maybe that's it. Maybe I should change that. Anyway, apologies out there. So I wanted to get into some cases, because I think there are some fascinating cases. O'Hare, we just mentioned. The JAL, what is it, 1686 or something like that?
I think it's 1637, I believe it is. That Dr. Haynes did an extensive study on this, and this was before my time, and really he's the person who would be able to tell you more about it. But in a nutshell, it involved a JAL pilot reporting an observation of a very large UAP in Alaska. And it was apparently picked up on radar at Elmendorf. And John Callahan, then director of Aviation Accidents Investigations, went there immediately to collect all the radar data, as he says it, at a dead run in front of the guys in black, trying to collect the data. Dick did a pretty thorough study on it. JAL fired Kenji Teruchi, the pilot.
They fired him? I never heard that. I heard he just got a desk job.
Well, they fired him, and then Dr. Haynes wrote a letter and got him reinstated, basically, because pilots do see these things, and he came from a position of authority. He was working in NASA at the time, and he kind of stood on what he had and went to bat for Kenji Teruchi and did a good job of it.
Great.
Dick's done a number of amazing reports. He's so detail oriented, and his materials are just fascinating. He did a study of the Tehran 1976 mm-hmm. case as well, and interviewed all the principals and everything. It's brilliant work. That's the one real great thing about Dr. Haynes, is he's so thorough and he's so careful and detailed.
Right. Anyway. Yeah. Right. Someone asked, they wanted to know what your own sighting, if you could, it sounds like you've had multiple sightings. All right. So mm-hmm. I'll just put it this way. What is the most incredible sighting you had, since you've had a few of them?
Yeah. You know, I've never been able to talk about them in public. I've talked about them privately, you know, but I've never been able
it's
to stand on the podium. It's just you and me. you know, because I'm an administrator, I'm not a researcher. I don't guide research. I got involved with this because I was highly motivated from personal experience. And the personal experiences that began in 1965 at age 5 and continued off and on through my life into my adulthood. And the last one happened in January of 1999. And it's what led me to Dr. Haynes. I wasn't well after that. What I saw was fantastic and unbelievable. And that and 575 will get you a Frappuccino at Starbucks. But it came right up. It was in the middle of Oakland, and was riding with some friends on the clover leaf of the Oakland Bay Bridge, mm-hmm. which was the Loma Prieta earthquake had destroyed a section of freeway. So the whole freeway clover leaf was kind of not the same pattern that it is now. And so we were up in a very high place up on these concrete pylons, and I looked out towards the Oakland Hills, and I said, now that's unusual. I saw a yellow light over a white light, maybe 4 or 5 miles away. And as we watched it, it turned from a pair of lights, it turned sideways and became a long yellow rectangle with two white lights underneath it. And we watched this as we were heading along 880 south on the Oakland side of the Bay Area. This thing came down Highway 24 below the level of the skyline. And my friend in the backseat and I were going through a whole list of things that it wasn't, like an airliner on fire heading to the bay, you know. And at one point it slowed down and stopped between us and the Oakland Federal buildings. It was about 3 miles away. And as we looked at it, I thought I was seeing silhouettes in the thing. And keep in mind, I've never told this story. Okay, I don't tell this story in public. I've told friends, but I this first time I've talked about this. You're scooping. Okay. And I watched this thing, and I had my eyes open. Fortunately, I wasn't blinking, because this thing leaped. It flitted from a couple miles away and came to a dead stop, less than its own length from the windshield of my car. And my partner was driving. My buddy Ian was in the back seat. It was 23 January at about 4:30 in the evening. So we were heading towards dusk, darkness, right? And then it matched our speed and then went in reverse as we drove down the road heading southbound with this thing hanging in front of our car. It was eight minutes to drive that particular stretch of freeway from beginning to the end of where our observation took place. And it took us 3 hours to cover that. There were 3 hours elapsed, linear time, in an 8 minute transit while we were driving. I got a good look at the inside of this thing, and it was occupied. And it revealed a couple of its own characteristics and maneuvers around us before it left. I have no idea why, no idea who. But I was living on a sailboat in Alameda Marina.
Oh, yeah. I right know where off, it is. You know. Yeah.
And this thing had gone, we went, Highway 24 is an overpass that comes down onto 880 right in front of the Oakland Police Station, basically. And this thing leaped over the 24 overpass and matched us just clearing the tops of the street signs, went right past the cop shop, went right down through the middle of Oakland with all the way in that it left us at Lake Merritt.
Yeah, I know where that is. I used to work in Oakland, so I know where you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, and I was living on a friend's sailboat in Alameda Marina, which is right across there, you know, with a great view of that whole area. And I'd get up in the morning and drink my coffee and sit on the fantail of the sailboat and just fall apart. I just couldn't function. It was completely obsessive. I couldn't get my mind off of it. I felt terribly threatened by it. I knew there was more to it that I didn't understand and that I needed to get a handle on it. And it wasn't forthcoming. I had nowhere to go. It's 1999.
Were you driving the car?
No. My partner, Susan, was driving the car.
Did you want to pull over or stop? Or you said three-hour span here.
I told her, pull over. You know, I said, pull over, please pull over. Frankly, if I'd had a shoddy in the trunk, I would have kicked the back window out and yanked the trunk open and, you know, started laying down cover fire. But I wanted her to stop the car. She refused. I had briefed her that I'd had these experiences and that she'd never been around me when it had happened. I'd ruined a couple of Thanksgiving dinners talking about this stuff, you know, and so finally she got a taste of it. And that changed her tune towards me. I started fishing around in ufology, trying to find something, anything. There wasn't really much. You know, the real story of this is that in 1990, when the Belgian thing was going on, I was watching CNN and I saw Major Wilfred de Brouwer step up, Belgian Air Force, and ask the world who these aircraft belonged to. They got like three news cycles out of him before they pulled it. And at the time, I realized that I was statistically above the average. It was kind of an awakening moment for me that, hey, I've got a few of these. I shouldn't have a few of these. Maybe one, but I shouldn't have a few of them. And maybe there's more to this. And so I spent the next 10 years studying it. I was in Berkeley. I'd go to Cody's bookstore and go through everything. I read Vallee. I read everybody that was out there. And which is the weird synchronicity about all of it, was because when it finally started happening again, I went through two or three, and then that big event happened. And then I reached out to NASA, and who comes out of it but Dr. Haynes.
Wow.
And then I end up with 17 years of doing this and taking a leadership role in this situation, finding responsibility and realizing that I needed to grow, and then accepting that challenge, doing the best I could.
Well, I got to tell you, that's one of the most amazing sightings I've heard. And it is so strange how you saw it off to the distance and then it came right focused right out. Actually, probably on you somehow, and just
it's the oddest thing,
and it just adds to the mystery. I mean, how could that ever be explained? Even if it was, let's just throw it out there. Let's just say, if it was extraterrestrial, for one, how could they possibly?
I personally, you know, there's two sides of it. Okay, as an administrator of a research group, my opinion kind of matters. But my own personal opinion is there's a higher order involved here. There's a higher order intelligence involved here. There's another step, and I don't know who they are or what they're about, but they understand reality and physics better than we do. They're not subject to the delusions that humans use to prop ourselves up from day to day. Delusions of money, delusions of words that have meaning, but aren't real. I don't think they function that way. I think they're rational and that they, you know, that they deal with things differently. And I would imagine that for us who are not rational, watching rational beings would be very puzzling, you know. So understanding it, I don't know. My guess is that there's a higher order. I don't know why it has an interest in people like me. I'm really not remarkable. But I have felt a responsibility with it to be careful. And people's children and families are involved in all of this. It's bigger than I am. And we have to be careful, really, really careful. Make good judgment calls. Try not to be narcissistic and pull it all on yourself. Oh, yeah, I saw them. They came right up to me. You know, you don't want to be that guy. You really don't.
Now, did you feel during this encounter, did you feel threatened, like physically threatened?
Yeah, I did. And I did because I have previous memories. So there's kind of trauma with it. Because Susan asked me, she was driving and I was sitting next to her. We were going to a party. And Susan's looking at this thing hanging in front of the car and these not people looking back at us. And she says, "Ted, are those?" Meaning, "Ted, are those aliens?" And I blurted out no and slid down in the seat. And I kind of lost track of things for a little bit. Had a definite trauma response to it, I guess you would say. And it goes back to experiences that I had before where I got hurt once, I think. I'm from Montana, okay? And I grew up in a time when nobody really had an answer for any of this. There was no little alien icon. There was no anything. There was a lot of question marks, and a lot of mystery, and a lot of fear. And the first fear I ever felt around it was when this thing was hanging in front of our car with my grandparents when I was age 5, and nobody knew what it was. I grew up in an aviation household. "Ted, that's a helicopter. Ted, that's a jet fighter. Look, there's a Sabre jet, you know. What the hell is that?" You know, nobody's got an answer for me. Nobody wants to talk. I can feel the fear in the car. You know, it's like having a big shark come up you and nowhere to go. Hmm. Or I used to think it was that way, but I've had big sharks come up to you. It's not like that.
So. You're doing free diving. Yeah. So this 3 hours, would you consider that missing time, or were you lucid the whole time and experienced the whole time?
I was lucid the whole time. Time passed quickly. My guess, okay, if you want to embrace it as technology, my guess was that there's an event horizon. This thing is decoupled from local space-time, and it has time shells of its own that conflict with the time shells of the object that we occupy, which is our planet. And when you get close to these things, there are temporal effects. That's my guess.
Wow, amazing.
This 575 will get you a Frappuccino to start with.
It kind of goes along, it kind of dovetails with some things that Ray Stanford has talked about on this show, the time thing you're just mentioning. And I'm going to make sure that he listens to the show. So I'm going to make sure he listens to that and see what his thoughts are about what you said.
If you think about it, Martin, Dr. Kaku, you asked about what Dr. Kaku thought. I was actually in a panel with Dr. Kaku, Dr. Belie, Dr. Heisch, Dr. Richard Con Henry, Dr. Sturrock, and John Callahan in a panel during this whole Podesta thing that was going on. They did a symposium at George Washington. And Dr. Kaku spoke on interstellar travel and explained how a way to think about it. Maybe you've heard of the Kardashev scale. Nikolai Kardashev offered that you could judge an extraterrestrial civilization's capacity by its ability to wield different sized radio signals. And the bigger the signal, the bigger control they had over power and technology in general in order to send out these signals. So, and then he characterized them as class zero, class one, class two, and class three civilizations.
Oh, yes.
So Dr. Kaku said, instead of looking at radio output, let's look at interstellar travel and where they would be, how much energy they would harness to be a class zero, one, two, or three, or whatever civilization. And this was my point earlier. What does a cusp class two, three civilization look like? How do you, it could probably come and go when it wants to, and it'll either let you know or not. You know, you might not ever know it was around. So anyway, he spoke quite a lot about this, about how interstellar travel and the capacity of other cultures will become based on gravitational theory as you get higher in class two and into class three civilizations. They'll be using general relativistic principles rather than thrust motors and the kind of things that we're using. So there are ways to look at this. I don't know that he's right. But we need some kind of a framework to project what is alien onto, so that we can make it less alien, so that we can understand. For example, there's no real understanding of interstellar migration and what might be the motivations for it, how it might be accomplished. Because my feeling is that if we're dealing with a non-terrestrial intelligence that's here now, he's been in space a long time. He's been living in space a long time. He's been moving in space a long time. However, if he's gotten to the point where he's using general relativity, then time's a whole different thing for him. What he does and how he does it, his relationship to the universe changes dramatically with those skills and that capacity. And we don't understand that. We don't know what that means. I just sense that there's something over the top of what we don't understand that exists at this next level.
Right.
And that could explain why some of us are, when we get close to these things, we have unusual interstates and unusual temporal experiences, time passing.
Wow. Max is awake. Say hi to Max. So listen, in the chat room, if you're listening live right now, if you would like to ask a question, if you'd like to join in the Google Hangout, all you have to do is type your email address or pop your email address in the chat room, and I will copy it, and I will invite you into this Google Hangout if you'd like to. Let's see. There are some questions. I know we have 20 minutes left, and it seems like I could talk to you for about 4 hours about this stuff. And I'm really, really glad I'll be seeing you in a couple of days, and hopefully you won't be too busy to sit and talk somewhere.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Now, someone wanted to know if you can tell us about the 2005 Palo Alto case. It was a small white ball of light flying near a airliner. Are you familiar with that case?
Yes, I am. In fact, I mentioned it a little bit earlier in our conversation about the astronomers that were in San Bruno, and they saw the airliner come over with a little ball of light following it as it came in to land at San Jose. And that's the case he's referring to, the Palo Alto case.
I see.
And I don't really know what to say other than that it looks like an energetic radiator. It could have, I suggested in my own paper that these things could be mistaken for ordnance. They look like the tail of a missile. And I've heard more than one pilot in his reporting say that at first he thought he was being fired upon, that he thought he was dealing with an air-to-air missile. You know, when he first saw the light coming at him, then he realized there was no missile body, no fuselage. So so in any case, with this sighting, I think is a really important one, because it's a sequence of photographs, and it shows what looks like behavior of this ball of light as it pulls up under the tail and it leaves. It's kind of frightening because the crew had no idea that it was there. Only people that knew it was there were the ground observers. And Dr. Haynes and Dominic Weinstein did a study of 56 cases involving electromagnetic effects on concurrent electromagnetic effects on aircraft during UAP sightings. And do you know that out of all 56 of them, all of them involved balls of light, not structured devices or objects? They all involved what were described as a radiators, black body radiators, balls of light. So my concern is when these, obviously there's a history of these reports, we need to understand what these things might be emanating and whether they're a threat to aircraft when they get close like that. One of our members, Neil Daniels, was a B-17 pilot during World War II, and then matriculated into commercial aviation and flew a full career as a commercial pilot, passenger aircraft pilot. And he had a really big ball of light show off of one wingtip of his aircraft, and it affected the magnetic compass, I believe, and the autopilot, and caused the plane to slightly veer to the right. Now, wow. Or towards the bank into the light, if I understand that report right. And so here's another case where the aircraft is an instrument that we can look at and say, okay, well, what happened? What could be hitting those sensors that would cause that aircraft to do that? You know, that there's a little clue about what's going on in there. Another thing is that you asked about these locations out around the world that we're looking at. What's really important, and a lot of us out here who are amateurs who have cameras might consider getting diffraction grating and putting it on your camera. And when you're capturing what you think are anomalies, you can get spectra data off of it. And that would be just such a terrific contribution to the study, is a drive to develop spectra data in what we're looking at, because then we can tell something about the light itself, what it's giving off, you know, what its composition might be. And starts to move us in a direction of stacking facts, stacking data, to where we can maybe name these things after after we get into it long enough.
Do you have any of that data at all from any source?
Some. There's some. And I wasn't the one to get a lot of this. I think Erling has some spectral data on things that they've seen out there, and I'm sure Dr. Teodorani does also. And this is part of where we're going with this study that at this site that I'm working on right now, is we're going to go and get spectral data on these phenomena.
Mm-hmm. If you would keep your eye open, because we may have someone join us. Someone just asked to join in, They are welcome to, let's see, the name is Kinsho. So Kinsho, if you want to go ahead and join us, go ahead and call in.
Is that K-E-N-S-H-O?
Is he one of your students?
No, Kinsho has a meaning. I just was curious.
Oh, okay. I was thinking one of your Japanese martial arts or sword, samurai sword, whatever the classes you're teaching. Pardon me for not calling it the right thing. Let's see. Someone also wanted to know, I'm not going to get to too many of these messages. Questions, that is, but someone to know, have you ever been in a position of presenting convincing evidence of anomalous UAP activity with no conventional explanation to someone who simply refused to accept the evidence? Have you ever lost your cool in such a situation?
You know, it's really interesting, because when you have the experience in your body and there's trauma involved, there's a real desperation to be believed. Mm-hmm. You know, you want people to believe you. You gotta believe me. You know, you think about that poor guy in Close Encounters, Richard Dreyfuss's character.
Yeah, yeah.
The changes he went through. I lived that and more. And I think a lot of us have, you know, that have been close to this. It can really just wreak havoc with your personal life. And so when you're challenged by people, I've come to the point where I'm pretty gentle with witnesses. I try to be careful. I don't have the answers. I understand the trauma. What they need is to know that they're not alone and that somebody else cares. And some of us who are in these higher positions, and I don't mean higher, but we're in these positions of looking into things, like I am as an administrator with NARCAP, we can help with that. We can help by being empathetic and careful and respectful. And whether or not we think it's mental illness or whether it's a real observation, I really can't say for most people. Like, sometimes it's pretty obvious they're not well, but a lot of times you can't be sure. And I'm not, given the weird things I've seen, I really can't judge others too much. You know, when they don't accept me, let me just give the best example I can of that. My father won't accept my stories and what I told you guys, even though my grandparents were there when some of these things happened.
Really? Wow.
And what I had to do was come to a place where it's not important that they believe me. Mm-hmm. It's important that I understand what happened to me. I don't need other people. What I need is mental health. I need to make sure that my awareness and my presence is properly centered in the moment, and that I'm not obsessed, and that I'm not delusional, and that I'm empathetic, because there is a there. There's something going on, and I've experienced it, and other people have experienced it, and I would be foolish to deny it, and I'd be even more of a fool to abuse people over it, you know. So even my dad, I'm kind of gentle with him. I understand what's going on there. It's unfortunate.
It's a hard pill to swallow for a lot of people, and I get that. So I wanted to ask you, one of the things I thought about asking you is, what do you consider the most astonishing case that I understand you didn't really invest or you've done some type of investigation, but since you've been, you have. Okay. So what is the most unusual case that you've looked at, or something that really left an impression on you, beside your own sighting, that is?
Well, the Palo Alto case is terribly interesting to me. That one is just, it's a really good example of what we're dealing with, I'm pretty sure. Someone has suggested that perhaps that's Venus. And I don't think it is. I don't think when you consider the case in its entirety, I don't think that's a probable explanation. And even if it is a possible one, it doesn't make it the correct one. We have a lot of these stories of balls of light following aircraft, and they're really interesting to me. And then having gone out and actually looked at phenomena and seen that the scope is wider than we thought, in terms of, okay, we've got spheres and discs and triangles and cylinders, and then we've got balls of light, and then we've got other stuff. And I've seen some of this, and we just don't be brittle in all of this. You got to watch really carefully what you're looking at. And I would include researchers and say, don't be brittle, because it may not be what you think it is. You know, we may be dealing with something perfectly natural, just poorly documented. You need to be able to flex that way. If that's where the data takes you, stay with the data, let your ego go and let the data lead you. And if it leads you to a mundane point, accept that, you know,
good advice,
but sometimes they don't lead you to a mundane place. And in that case, hold your ground, you know,
you're right.
Stand by it, you know, and then there's information. That's where you build from. Don't wait for society to pat you on the back and say, good job, you must be right. You know, make sure your logic is right. Make sure your deductions are correct. Make sure you've done your work. Make sure you've asked the right questions. Make sure that you're not trying to feed your own ego. You know, and for God's sakes, don't put the information out there until you have a full write-up with it. I mean, look at YouTube, you know, it's just full of all this stuff, and oh, that's an alien this, and it's a UFO that, but there's nothing. People ask me, oh, what do you think of this video? Well, like, it's a video I can't tell you, because there's no context at all, you know, and that's the whole purpose of these white papers, is to give context, explain how this happened and what occurred. And then we can look at these things and maybe deduce what they mean, but at least we've documented that they've occurred and done it accurately, you know, clearly.
Really, really good. Really good advice. You know, I do have to apologize to the people that have written questions in the forum. I'm not able to get to a lot of them. So here's one here. Do you think the reluctance of the greater scientific community to even entertain extraterrestrial hypothesis is based scientific reasons and scientific method, or are there social, economic, or political pressures to play that bigger part of this reluctance among the scientists? I thought that was a pretty good question.
It is a good question, and all of those factors weigh in, I think. And I think the some of it has to do with, it's just outside of the specialty. You know, if it isn't your specialty, scientists are pigeonholed. They tunnel into what they do, and they do that, and they do it very well, that thing, whatever that is. And so to get them to come out of that pigeonhole and deal with something that may be not at all related to what they're doing, is hard to do. And particularly when funding's involved and image is involved and careers are involved, not many people are really ready to risk that. And at the same time, there are others who are perfectly fine with standing up and looking at it with both feet planted on the ground and offering their opinion and marching merrily on with their jobs. Science, my experience is science is always, not always, but science often comes behind the observation. First, we see something unusual, then science comes and looks at it, and then it tells us about it. But we saw it first. And that's kind of where we're at right now. And it's a tactical problem for us at this point, I think. And science will come along with validation as more data develops. But the initial vigilance, the initial leaning into it and looking, paying attention, is already going on. You can't put it back in the box. And at some point, it'll get where it needs to go. You can't keep this down forever if there's a there, if it's real, if I'm not delusional.
I have a feeling you're not. I have sent... Yeah, I just to let the listeners know, you probably have to check your mailbox. I'm not really sure this is the first Google Hangout I've done like this. But Sandra and Ryan, I think it's Ryan, I have both sent you invite. Bruce, that is. Bruce, I sent you both invites. If you want to, when he wants to jump in and ask a question, go ahead and connect with us. You mentioned Dr. Vallee.
Mm-hmm.
Got to meet him last year. Great guy, very a real icon. What do you think about his philosophy of that the this phenomena could be all kinds of things? Do you think that's accurate?
I'm not going to second guess Dr. Vallee. He spent a long time in the field looking at it, and he's developed his perspective. I do think that we aren't very comfortable not having an answer. And in that state, a lot of ideas come up and a lot of paths are trod trying to work them out. And Dr. Vallee has certainly been wrestling with this in his life for a long time, you know, since I was a kid, you know, and I'm not going to second guess his journey and how he got there and what his opinions are today. I certainly respect him and respect that. I may not necessarily agree with it in its entirety from my own experience, but I don't have the answers, so I can't say he's wrong. You know, I will say that a civilization that's functioning in general relativistic principles may look very disjointed and irrational, and may have appearances or capacities that we just didn't imagine. And in that sense, we're seeing them and encountering them and trying to explain them. And Dr. Vallee is doing his path on that. He's certainly been an icon. It's been a privilege working, you know, in an organization with him involved. And he's always been gracious and decent to me. And pretty much in his conduct in public, he's always been good to people. So in that sense, he's a good role model, I think.
Yes.
Although I would tell you, work your own logic, work your own rationale until you understand what you're trying to do.
When I met him, the thing that impressed me, I couldn't believe how tall he was.
He's a tall man. I was starstruck when I first met him. I was invited to an SSE, Society for Scientific Exploration, event in San Diego in 2001. And Dr. Haynes told me that he had invited Dr. Vallee to join our organization. And I was just shocked, and then met him and Hal Putoff and Dean Radin. And just,
oh, Hal Putoff.
Mm-hmm. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah. One last question, and I have a final question, and we're going to be wrapping up fairly soon in about 4 or 5 minutes. But what would you categorize as NARCAP's most significant accomplishment so far?
Surviving 17 years without
mm-hmm.
killing our credibility. You know, I would say that's probably our first really great accomplishment for getting this far down the road without stepping in it too badly. And then, and I think that what we're looking at is, I'm actually, we didn't mention it here on the show, but Dr. Haynes is retiring.
Oh,
he's stepping down from leadership with NARCAP, and his 80th birthday is coming up. So we're looking at a restructuring of the organization. I'm going to continue with the program as long as it makes sense to do that. And there are plenty of people doing very good aviation investigations out there. So I don't think there's a lack of talent if I want to pull in a core investigative team. And I don't think Dr. Haynes is completely out of the picture. If we needed him for advisement, I think he'd be there for us. So that's kind of the future of NARCAP is in a there's some things I would do differently given the chance to restart it, and I have that chance. So yeah, I'm going to reorganize a little bit.
Yeah, that was my question, was what do you think the future is of you know, of NARCAP? And so that's basically it. Now, you know, technology keeps changing all the time, so we have no idea what that's going to do as far as this field goes.
Well, it's put a lot of tech in the hands of what I call the next generation researcher. We've spent a lot of time looking at the icons who brought us here, and a few of us have been mentored by them. A few of us have been at the feet of Fran Ridge and Dr. Haynes and Dr. Belee and others. And
okay,
this next generation. Okay, sure.
Yeah. Sorry to just pop them in like this. You happen to look down.
Yes.
Sorry about that.
How you doing? What's your first name and where are you calling from?
This is Ken Shaw. I'm calling from New Jersey here.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, welcome.
Good to meet you. Sorry about just popping in like that. I'm just, yeah, if it's not too late. I just have a simple question to ask. I know right now you maintain a database full of reports, and reports keep coming in. Approximately speaking, how many of those reports, like what percentage of those reports you think are just more or less misidentifications of things like stars, planes, the ISS, things like that? Basically, what percentage of reports do you think have some promise versus percentage that's just misidentified?
That's a great question, and I would just say it this way. We don't know what the base number of pilot reports are out there for me to give you that breakdown. But I will tell you that for every case we learn of, there are probably hundreds that are not reported. And a lot of them involve very unusual things. And that's why they're not reported, because the pilots are very sure that they shouldn't talk about them versus mystified at maybe a bolide or something like that. And to be sure, there are misidentifications. The most promising cases involve multiple aircraft, air traffic control facilities, radar data, ground observers, this kind of thing. So, you know, we're looking for more eyes. And then once we have these cases, it's just the case. The next question is, what do you do now that you know that these things are happening? What does the aviation community do? How do they mitigate or develop and track this data? So I think the best thing that could happen is that the FAA just stop purging UFO cases. If it just said it's willing to hear from the pilots and didn't say anything more and allowed them an even channel, we would get a better answer to those questions you posed. And they're a good question.
Right. Okay, that makes sense.
I have a question for you. Ken Shaw?
Yes, that's me. What's up?
Yes. Ken Shaw. You want to share the root of that?
Okay, so I know you said it has a meaning. It probably does. But for me personally, it's a combination of my first name and last name. That's all
it is. That's very good. That's very good. I appreciate you clarifying that. Yeah, you might look that up if you don't know what that means.
I will look that up, actually. I didn't know that.
Look it up in the context
of the language.
Pen and sword. Yeah. Yeah, that actually
gets me down. All right, definitely.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right.
My pleasure.
Now, just we're really out of time here, but I did want to ask you what your opinion about the Frederick Valentich Cessna case. That was just a fascinating case in Australia. That was all the way back up. I don't remember.
1971.
Decades ago.
Yeah. Dr. Haynes did an extensive study of that one, also wrote a book on it, actually, and he offered four different possible solutions to what happened there, including the one that seemed most obvious, that Freddie was taken by something. His father passed away recently, so I don't know how much conversation even continues on the subject in the family, but that case is it's a haunting case. Somebody's gone, you know. And the circumstances around it, his last radio transmission, is extremely provocative.
Really something. You know? Ted, yeah. I'm really looking forward to meeting you in a couple of days only. And
won't be long.
All right. So, all right, everyone. So that's the end of our show this evening. And I want to thank you for listening in. And next week we'll be at the UFO Congress, and hopefully we'll have a good video set up. And I'm taking a different computer. We'll see if there's no static. That would be nice. Thanks again, Ted. It was a real pleasure, and I'm looking forward to seeing you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much, Martin. Anytime.